get a warm from Rochester.
Yeah.
I've been back and forth. Pam Merkel's coming down to meet with me. We're going to go through the website for that assessment tool on the 19th of March. And I'm
okay.
Glad to be involved. I'm in here down here.
Welcome. We almost have a quorum. Perhaps the testifier for House Lot 2587 can come to the table. We have some bills today. We're trying to get a lot of work done in one day. We lost the committee time, and I think there's adequate time for the bills, especially if we just kind of move along with them. So. And so, Mr. Schoenbaum, welcome to the committee. When we get a quorum, we're going to move the bill. Is this being held over, or is this going? And so, Representative Garofalo is the author is in his committee, and Representative McDonald's on his way. I'm an author of the bill, so we'll present it some way. But it's a good bill anyway. So, I think you have some bipartisan support on it, perhaps. So, with the I can't move the bill yet, but I can sure hear what's in it. So
thank
why
you,
is this bill
Mr. Chairman,
so good?
And members, Mark Schoenbaum from the Health Department. I do feel the absence of my author here, but as you said, a number of the rest of you are authors as well. So we'll proceed at your request.
Well, Mr. Schoenbaum, you have a quorum and an author, so go ahead and so. I will move a House Bill 2587, be recommended it pass, and be sent to the General Register.
Thank you.
So what's the bill all about anyway?
As all of you know, the state for many years has had a loan forgiveness program that provides incentives to new graduates in various occupations to practice in areas where they are needed most, including rural areas in the state. Last winter, the Health Department, on its normal cycle, made preliminary commitments to the new set of applicants for the program. And with that commitment, the applicants in good faith went ahead and sought jobs in those qualifying areas, including rural areas. We do not make a contract with those applicants until such time as they get that job and provide us that documentation. The legislature last year considered a change in the definition of rural that made it somewhat more narrow. There was not an opportunity during the shutdown to connect all the dots, and when the bills were passed, it turns out that six of those applicants who had gone and secured jobs, those jobs are no longer in eligible rural areas. It's an unintended consequence. We budgeted for those participants. This bill simply grandfathers them in and follows through on the commitment that we've made.
That sounds great. Representative McDonald, do you have any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, it's a great bill, and I urge all of you to support it.
Any questions from members? Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. You know, this kind of program is really important, and I'd actually love to see this expanded a lot more. It's really barely enough money to do this, and I actually have in my own district a young dentist who's, you know, my district doesn't obviously qualify as rural in Rochester, but there are populations that are quite low income, and people who go there and serve those low income populations don't get any help. And there's a particular dentist that I see there who is working with disabled and low income folk and isn't eligible for this, and it's really a problem. So I really support this, and I hope we can even do better as we go forward.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, to your point, you have a handout on the requirements for the different occupations, and you will find that actually when the legislature added dentistry to the occupations, the obligation of dentists is not actually a geographic one. it is an obligation to serve the population that you just mentioned. We'd certainly encourage you at the health department to point that person to the program, we'll all hope that they're a successful applicant.
Mr. Stone, you want to follow up?
Well, Mr. Chair, thanks. We've looked into it, and I don't know what the discrepancy is here, but we did try to, you know, we had staff check out for this person whether she was eligible, and I mean, maybe we could talk about it more offline, but we tried, so I'm kind of surprised to see that this would be the case. I don't know, maybe there was another reason she didn't fit.
Maybe you can go to the hallway after this thing. And Mr. Schoenbaum, can you refresh my memory? Was this this program at the end was reduced by half and then focused more rural, is that right?
Correct, that Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And just so members know, it left the house intact. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so just to know who likes it. And anyway, so any other questions about this? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that this House File 2587 is recommended pass and go to the General Register. Thanks for good testimony. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you.
Good bill. Next bill is Representative Norton. He's here. We have two Norton bills. 2094 is the first one. And Representative Norton is moving that to go to be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you move my bill? I'm not in the committee.
I'm sorry. It seems like you're always here.
Sorry.
So anyway, I will move the bill for possible inclusion.
Okay, and there is a DE1.
You know, it's funny to get confused, a little early thing going on here.
And there is a DE1 amendment, if you could, that has language we've worked
out. And I'll move the DE1 amendment. This is the first hearing of the bill, is that right?
Yes, it is.
So then it's just to get it in order. So all in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed. It's adopted. Representative Norton, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair and members, this bill is brought to you because of some changes in DHS. As you all know, when new people come in, either a new position or a change in turnover of a whole department, that can mean that there are changes in interpretation of law and procedure and process. And in this case, the area that was affected was volunteer dentist services, as experienced by our Salvation Army Good Samaritan Dental Clinic and other clinics around the state. And so we have been working with the department for many months now, and they've been quite helpful. We've tried to find a solution, and with some discussion with the dentist who you're going to hear from in just a moment and their business office, we would like to codify this in law so that we don't always have this possibility that something could change and be interpreted differently. And so what this will do is allow these dentists and other dentists, about 40 to 50 of them, I believe, that volunteer at the Good Samaritan Dental Clinic in Rochester and, as I said, in other places across the state, who volunteer their time to continue to do so and not be affected by having to be an MA provider or fall under the mandates of Rule 101. I personally believe that Rule 101 should be removed. I think it has done more harm than good in the area of dentistry by requiring if you take an MA patient, you're required to take 10% in your practices with the high overhead in small dental offices and the low reimbursement rate. It just doesn't fit a business model. I know it was put into law for the very best of intentions, but it has actually done more harm than good in the long run. Since that bill hasn't gotten a hearing, I'm moving ahead with this little fix, which at least will allow dentists who do volunteer to not have to be MA providers and meet that 10% threshold. So with that, I do have Dr. Tom Sitzer from the Good Samaritan Dental Clinic and his finance officer, and perhaps they can just give you a little bit of information if the chair...
Yeah, that's great. I have a question for you first, though.
Okay.
It appears that there's no fiscal note on this. I may have to modify my motion. What happened to the fee the board wanted to collect? Did that get squared away somehow?
We have worked this out with the department. They've looked it over and are able to implement this without cost.
The board's not requiring a fee anymore.
No, not for these people.
It's just so small, it's inconsequential. But there's no fee, and so
no, the fee was with the a different bill.
Oh.
With the temporary dentist, that has the $25 fee, and I you may or may not be hearing that at a later time.
Okay. But anyway, so there's no fiscal note on this, so because they're already doing the place is already billing, so this will be going to the floor.
Okay, that would be
okay
fine.
With you. So, yeah, I'd like to hear from your witnesses, so
sure.
I'll modify my motion later.
All right.
Welcome to the committee, doctors.
Good afternoon. I'm Tom Sitzer, pediatric dentist from Rochester, and was involved in putting together this clinic through the Olmsted County Public Health Department, the Zumbro Valley Dental Association, and dentists from the surrounding area. We started our work about 11 or 12 years ago. We did our due diligence, and we did surveys and had any number of dentists. I think at the time about 75. There's 90 dentists in the area. 75 returned to their survey, and 50 or so volunteered, which was a wonderful thing to see. We weren't sure what we were going to have, but we were under the impression when we first started our clinic about 3 years later after building it and getting help from the Mayo Clinic and finally getting started in the summer of 2002, we operated under the impression that we were going to have a clinic number that would go on our reports to the state billing area, and we're told that we didn't, that wouldn't work, that we needed to have the individual doctors sign up for medical assistance, and then they would consequently have to see 10%, as Representative Norton explained. This we finally reached an agreement with the Department of Human Services, and they agreed to have my name as the director put on all the billing sheets, but we would keep track of who did the work, and they had to be qualified and have a license from the state of Minnesota. Recently, this was changed, and we were told that we had to have each dentist sign up to participate in the program. This bill has been represented, has been worked over by Representative Norton and the DHS, and we feel that it meets our needs. It doesn't require the dentists to see a certain percentage of medical assistance in their private practice, and yet they can volunteer at our clinic. Someone that knows more about the billing aspect of this is Mr. Dan Marcel, and he can expand on what I just said. Thank you.
And Mr. is it Dr. Marcel or
no
Mr. Marcel? Yeah. So just a kind of a brief couple minutes on that.
Sure.
Okay. I think people like your bill, so. You don't need great. To oversell it.
Okay, great. I'm a quick learner, I hope. The Salvation Army serves a population of Olmsted County residents that are either uninsured or, as we refer to them, as underinsured, meaning they have some form of medical assistance coverage provided by the state. As you're probably well aware, those people who are seeking dental care who are insured through Medicare, medical assistance or Minnesota Care, do have difficulty being accepted as patients in private dental practices, at least in our area. The Good Samaritan Dental Clinic, as Dr. Sitzer said, was set up specifically with the intention to deliver care to those people. We see about 12 to 1,300 people annually we have since we've opened, and probably if we had more money to expand our facilities, we could even see more. We see those people about 1,800 to 2,000 times a year. Our budget to operate this dental clinic runs just short of $250,000 or so.
we do a lot of fundraising to offset those expenses, but a significant revenue stream that helps us keep our doors open and serve those very patients comes from our medical dental insurance reimbursements from the state. And as we understood in our discussions starting earlier this year from DHS, unless we were able to change our process to submit the names of the actual providers who treated our patients with medical assistance or Minnesota Care, that revenue stream would be jeopardized. And the Salvation Army has a habit when funding starts to fall by the wayside, we start to decrease our spending. And that's what we would do, and therefore be able to not serve as many patients. So I think this bill, as amended by Representative Norton in my quick reading of it, because it's very representative of the discussions we'd had earlier with DHS and Assistant Commissioner Lights, addresses our needs. We surveyed our dentist, which, as Dr. Sitzer mentioned, are 50 or so volunteer dentists who, without them, our clinic could not operate. And those that we've spoken with find this amendment, language in the amended bill, acceptable. So I think this would address our needs.
And it appears they've actually stumbled on a way to make dentistry affordable in the medical assistance system, which is to pay the dentist nothing, which is maybe not the direction you want to go, but that's supposed to be a joke, because it's so difficult to meet your costs. And, you know, I've been talking about that since I've been here, too, so it's a hard problem to solve. But I'm happy you're able to find something to meet your needs here. Representative Norton, are there questions from members? Anybody in the audience want to testify about this? You want a final word?
I would. I just want this committee to understand what's happened with dental care for the poor and the disabled in our part of the state. There are no providers any longer. I think the few that we've had have closed their doors because of the cuts to the rates, and there is no place for folks to go save driving up here to the Twin Cities, and it's just an unacceptable situation. And so while this bill fixes a small problem, I think we as a committee really need to grapple with how are we going to get people out of the emergency room and doing the kind of preventive care that they need to get appropriate services all over the state of Minnesota. So
I think you've expressed the sentiment of the committee on that matter. I just have one more question, then we can probably vote. The written, are there other sites that would benefit by this? If Brainerd want to do something like this, they could set up this kind of a program, I suppose. And so is there any other models, Mr. Sitzer? Is there any models that, or no, Mr. Marcel, is any other models
you
know of that?
The Caring benefit? Hands Clinic operates in Alexandria. They, in fact, used our clinic as a model when they started planning back in the 2006 or so time frame. I've been in conversation with their executive director, Mr. Al Olson, there, and they have taken actions to try to deal with issues they have with DHS in a little bit different form than we have. But my understanding from the Caring Hands Clinic is that they would find this bill perfectly acceptable and not harm what they're doing currently.
Seems like a good resolution and maybe a model for some other places that want to do a similar thing, if it's in Duluth or wherever else. Any other questions people have? Seeing none, I'll actually change my motion that House File 2094 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Everybody understand that motion?
Mm-hmm.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much, and thanks for stopping in today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Norton, you have another bill.
I do and, have another bill. We'll try to be as quick as that one. And again, Mr. Chair, I'm going to need you to, you or a member, to move House file for me.
No, Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair.
We're going to, do you want to move it?
Yeah.
Okay,
please.
Sorry,
yeah.
We're just talking about the bill. Yeah, go ahead.
Right, well, I would like to move House file 2571, and is this one
This
as
is
well?
Going to stay here. There's a fiscal note that's
yep.
pending.
Okay. And the A1 amendment.
For possible inclusion. And so then if you want to move the amendment, Representative...
And then I would move the A1 amendment.
Now, is this an amendment to the bill? Oh, this looks kind of small.
Mr. Chair, if I could, the A1 amendment CMS weighed in on Wednesday of this week that what we were trying to do, which is carve out a tiny fiscal note and just affect a very small group of people, is not to their acceptance. And so we are taking out that whole section that carves it out, which again will provide a larger fiscal note. But frankly, I think that fiscal note will be instructive to this body. So we welcome the fiscal note, and then we can move from there. The department is working with us to see if they can't find better language, but for now we're just going to remove it.
Well, this body welcomes instructions. So any other questions about the amendment? And Representative Liebling has moved it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Amendments adopted. Representative Norton, to your bill.
Thank you. And I do have a handout for the committee members. I don't know how many are left, if there's a page somewhere. There we go. Thank you. Members, House File 251 is amended. Is meant to support an excellent pilot program that began a few years ago in Rochester. Appletree Dental serves our nursing homes, and I had an opportunity to watch them in action. They move equipment in a room that's emptied for them. They set up chairs, and the seniors are rolled down and provided great dental care, actually right on site. And at the time, I had been talking with Hiawatha Homes and some members of our community that have housing and care for the disabled about what a great model this would be if we could roll the equipment into the ICFMRs, the housing units, and just provide service to the disabled right there, because again, our folks have to be driven up to the Twin Cities for the most part for any care. So we thought, what a great idea. We can save some money, and they'll explain to you what they've done. But that program, which was a grant, and they can explain that to you too, Mayo Clinic supports it, was put in place, and then last year, several of the cuts that we put in place affected some billing codes that have had now are jeopardizing the whole project, which was a cost savings to the program, a small cost savings to the state as well. And so I'm going to let them explain what happened, or their program, and how it's been affected, and see if we can't find a fix, either small or large.
And how much did we save, do you remember?
She's going to explain
that
to
you. Okay,
that's
all part of it. Okay.
Yep.
Sorry to jump ahead.
Nope.
Welcome to the committee. I can't wait to hear their number.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and thank you for taking some time to listen to this bill today. My name is Cindy Ostrowski, and I'm the Executive Director of Hiawatha Homes in Rochester. I've been supporting people with developmental disabilities for 22 and a half years. And some very concerning things have happened over the last several years, and that is the ability for people with disabilities to access quality dental care and dental services, especially for those individuals who have very complex medical needs, seizures. They may be on several different medications, and they may have behavioral support needs as well. We, back in 2008, in the handout that you have, in talking to Representative Norton, she kind of challenged us to say, hey, why don't you go out and get some numbers, get some figures, start thinking about some efficient, effective ways to do services. Appletree is doing some services in the nursing home. Why don't you go take a look at what they're doing? So in 2008, I worked with Leanne Bieber from the Quality Assurance Project and Elaine Ingalls, a licensed social worker, and we gathered some information, which we provided to you. And in that information, it shows that in a five-county area, there was 846 people supported. 281 of those individuals needed to go out of town just to get dental access. They traveled anywhere between 30 and 300 miles round trip just to get to the dentist. And so we tried to highlight the best we could what kind of expenses there were to providers, maybe from our just cost of care, other services where there was specialized transportation needed through MA support dollars for specialized transportation. In traveling that far, that many miles, there's staff, there's nursing staff, there's direct care staff, there's costs for meals and other associated items, and we've tried to highlight those for you. So what we've been doing the last 2 years is planning and trying to implement a program in Olmsted County area, starting with Hiawatha Homes, but hoping to reach out to other areas in Olmsted County as well as throughout Minnesota, especially rural Minnesota. and some of those counties as well. What we've started to do is through a grant, through Mayo Clinic grants and other grants that AppleTree Dental sought out, we started services in July of 2011. And since that time, AppleTree has visited 8 different times, 6 different months. Sometimes, to be efficient, we go 2 days at a time. And we've served people from Hiawatha Homes as well as other people from the community. AppleTree has been able to support 27 individuals from Hiawatha Homes and 2 from the community, and through those services, we've been able to save money on our transportation and staffing. We estimate just alone Hiawatha Homes, and not including any MA specialized transportation, could save over $3,000 just by having our staff staying local with the individuals and really doing the care that they're supposed to be doing in the homes, in the programs, in the communities, and not spending their time out and about traveling 300 miles round trip. I have to tell you that the services that Dr. Christian, our dentist, provides to the individuals is excellent. Because the service is provided to the individuals on site, she is able to do what she needs to do when individuals are using their wheelchair. If someone feels more comfortable in a beanbag chair, she'll be standing, she'll be sitting, she'll be bending, she'll be next to a beanbag chair. She does whatever she needs to do to make sure that the individuals get a good, thorough cleaning. We've had testimony from family members that have been traveling with their sons or with their daughters to specialized dental services. They've called us back and said, "I can't believe that my daughter actually received such a good cleaning. Her teeth have never looked this good in years." We have one gentleman who lives right next door to our main office where we're able to set up the dental unit. And because of his significant needs and disabilities, he does use a ventilator, so he needs a LPN with him at all times. And because of his physical disabilities, he does not feel comfortable going out into the community to a dentist. And sometimes he has not been able to see a dentist for 2 or 3 years at a time. He has now been able to very comfortably, with really minimal anxiety, bring his wheelchair and his staff person down to the office to get his dental cleanings, and it's just been a great asset to have them there. So we hope to continue this program with individuals, like I said, in Olmsted County as well as southeastern Minnesota, and be cost-effective with our services instead of spending money on transportation and specialized transportation, spend it locally with the individual's care that they need. Even with minimum fees and reduced fees that AppleTree's been able to provide to our individuals, as Representative Norton said, when individuals only receive $92 a month for personal needs because of their high medical needs and other complications, we need to have them get their teeth cleaned on a regular basis to prevent emergency room visits, other costly doctor's visits from other complications of medical concerns that come up with infection in an individual's mouth. So we hope that this local quality on-site dental care that we can offer good cleanings can help be proactive and not reactive. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Helgeson, do you want to say something?
Yes, thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Abler and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Michael Helgeson, the CEO of AppleTree Dental. As some of you know, I'm actually a geriatric and special needs dentist, so I have expertise treating the kinds of patients that are at Hiawatha Homes and in nursing facilities. There aren't too many geriatric dentists running around, so I'm in a small group, but I'd like to think that we have something to offer for people that really are a little bit more complicated than an average dental patient. As many of you know, AppleTree is a nonprofit group dental practice. We have programs in 5 regions of Minnesota, and we target our services to children and disabled adults and elders who face barriers to care. And you heard about that in the earlier bill with, you know, depending on volunteers in many cases to try to take care of patients. And that works for many patients, but in particular not very well for people that are institutionalized that really have a different set of needs. We do use trucks and mobile offices to create year-round dental homes at each of the sites where we provide care. And our goal is really a common goal, I think, for everyone in healthcare, which is to provide better healthcare to have better health care outcomes, but to do that in a way that lowers total costs. And I think what happened in recent years is that the limited adult benefit set cut out what I call the special care benefits. Those are the benefits for house calls, so to bring the dentist into the institution where the person lives. Behavior management, that's 15 minutes of additional staff time and effort and help address and compensate for behavior challenges so that people can get the care that they need. And sedation, these are the items that we're looking at trying to reinstate. These are benefits that really open the door for any dental benefits. If you can't get to the patient, you can't work with their behavior, nothing happens. They don't get an exam, they don't get a cleaning, whatever infections are in their mouth continue to spread. In a program that we piloted a few years earlier in the Twin Cities at Mount Olivet, Rolling Acres, we found in a chart audit of about 54 patients looking back before we provided on-site care, about 90% of those individuals had a record that they had gone to a dentist, but the dentist was unable to complete an exam, and they were unable to have their teeth cleaned successfully because of their behaviors. That translates into 90% of the visits being paid for, but without an outcome. And the outcome was the patient didn't get a complete exam and a cleaning. We implemented on-site care, again, working hand-in-hand with the staff at Mount Olivet Rolling Acres and providing services right where the patients live, often in their own restroom or wherever they're most comfortable, to get a look in their mouth and to work with them. And they don't have the same behaviors when you see them right where they live. It's a very different experience than transporting them for hours and then they're in a scary dental office. And many of them are at wit's end when they get there. And so, of course, they're not going to open their mouth and be a happy dental patient for that. Within about a year's time, with on-site care, we were able to effectively provide those basic services, a good exam and a good cleaning, for 90% of the patients, with about 10% still needing sedation or to go to a hospital for general anesthesia, that sort of thing. But our goal is to provide the best care at the lowest cost. It was mentioned that this study was done, about $100,000 was spent in transporting patients. And so what we're hoping is that we'll be able to help people maintain a healthy mouth and avoid transportation and other costs and drive down total health care costs. So thank you.
Thanks. And I have it's interesting that we pay for people trying to do a service, but that's a different discussion for a different day, which is interesting. Can you tell me which of the, I appreciate your testimony, and I'm very familiar with your Appletree Dental, and for the new members who haven't heard about this work, they are a really good organization. They travel around, and I've had the privilege of touring their facility, and they have seminars set up facilities, and somebody's hard to handle people that they have to sedate. And I know Epson and Bunn worked on this a couple years ago, and now we're in another time of shortfall. And some of the services you're trying to get back were some of those that were deemed to be easier to reduce than others. Of the services you're doing now, or what happens now with the transportation and, you know, the near-miss visits that you have to pay two to do one of them, do you have any, I'm trying to help you with your fiscal note issue, do we pay for the transportation to go wherever as part of our state transportation monies? Are there other costs, like ER costs that we're incurring because they can't get this done as Appletree would do in the bill?
Well, I'm going to let...
do you know that offhand?
Yeah, I'm going to let Cindy respond because she knows a good part of it. But we actually had a talk. Non-emergency medical transportation can be used by individuals on MA, as you well know. So there are some savings to the state. What we found, however, was many of some of the counties are actually billing when Hiawatha Homes transports people to the others, and others haven't. They've taken it out of their own personal bottom line. So there is a discrepancy in how that's handled across the state, but I'll let her address the rest of the savings.
And I don't want a big detail now, but just as you work on the fiscal note, and you can comment, but I mean the departments here, so they're paying attention to this, I know, because they, you know, we don't get to do the third iteration of a cost, but if you're not doing this and doing something else, that's a direct failure to be able to provide the service. So maybe you can mention a little bit about that.
One example in the handout is, we did not associate agencies with numbers, but Hiawatha Homes happened to be the first one on there. And for those individuals where it says provider mileage expenses, we took that, Hiawatha Homes took that out of just what the state gives us to provide services. Other agency, as Representative Norton mentioned, actually worked to get some of that money back and bill MA for that service. But on the next category where it says MA transportation, because of the specialized needs of many of our individuals and how they have to be transport, that was spending that was billed to a special transportation through MA dollars. That we've been able to save, at least Hiawatha Homes, for the individuals able to stay local at Hiawatha Homes. We have not billed for, the individual has not billed for specialized transportation because we're able to use our own van and just drive down to our main office. So for us, Hiawatha Homes, that we've been able to save some taxpayers' dollars that way, as the individual themselves has not had to bill a transportation company, has not had to bill to take them down to our main office for their dental visit.
And Mr. Chair, part of our issue has been with this pilot project, and of course a lot of it is supported by grants, which we hope will continue, and we hope this concept could grow. There are two or three billing codes in particular that have been affected. They don't affect very many people in the state of Minnesota, and the argument we made with the department was the savings you're going to make in non-emergency medical transportation and those other siloed amounts really is probably going to be less, actually, than we're asking for a handful of people. I think there were 7 or 8 of them at the time, 12. Now there's 12 individuals who need these extra codes, which account for $80. Mm-hmm. It's a very tiny amount of money, but that the billing, that $80 goes to the person. So that one person who has $92, as she said, to spend in a month, they have a dental visit, and all that money has gone on the one dental visit to pay for the extra behavioral management that's needed or additional anesthesia or medication. So,
and Representative Norton, you probably weren't here for the fiscal update, but Mr. Hoffman did talk about reasonable flexibility, and so I'm looking for some of that, and I think the more you can help them include other offsets, I mean, that are bona fide, not just, we can't make up things, but right. If there's just the thought is to be inclusive enough in the true costs that would be offset by your work, and unfortunately, quality and quality of life don't have a price tag on them, and they have quite a bit of value to me, so.
They certainly do for the individuals. I went in as Representative Liebling. I think Quam and Benson all went into that day and saw some absolutely fantastic dental care given to some very vulnerable patients, and they were. It was wonderful. It was great to see. There should be more of that.
Representative Laughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Norton. I'm glad you're addressing an important issue. And I know your original intent was to focus on people who are in residential settings other than home, but now that you have had to broaden it, I'm wondering if you really do want to limit it to adults, because there are obviously children and teenagers who have the exact same challenges. I do think that, you know, while it will have an impact on the fiscal note, it actually, as you have pointed out, may have some savings as well. And I'd also like to point out that our solution should work both for the fee-for-service and the managed care system, because these people will be going into managed care. They have an opt-out, but many of them will choose to go into managed care, and this will have to be dealt with in that system as well.
Dr. Helgeson.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative. I just wanted to comment that children's dental benefits for these items were not cut. So when the cuts went through, they were part of what was called the limited adult benefit set, and these house call and behavior management were cut for adults, but they're still in place for children.
Okay, thank you.
So that's why they're not in place here. And interestingly, the health plans are very interested in this topic. They see this as an issue that has an impact on things like emergency department visits, which were referenced, people who are diabetic, their total health care costs. Several recent studies show their total health care costs are 10 to 15% higher if they're not receiving regular dental care and regular dental cleanings, and they have chronic infections in their mouth. So they've been very interested in this, but they're sort of hamstrung when these benefits are not in the covered set for adults. So I think this would help address the issues that you mentioned.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Norton and testifiers, and I do appreciate all that good work. It's a loving work that you do for people who need extra loving. The one thing, you know, when you just look at it financially sometimes, is it cheaper to pull a tooth, fix a cavity, or prevent the cavity? And that's where the quality of life and other factors kind of come in. But if you just took it just plain old from money, but having grown up in a situation of having a pulled tooth because of that cavity and how painful it is, I know the quality of life, and I much prefer not to have that. So, and I thought he was going to get another one, and I fainted sitting up in the chair. And just not in a situation anybody wants to go through. So prevention is really important, even though at times it may have a cost. But I think in the long term, I think all those things balanced out, and I think that's what we're talking about over that. So thanks for all your good, loving care. Appreciate that, and I know that we intend to do everything we can to help rectify this.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. And actually, Dr. Helgeson sort of started to get into this a little bit, and I just kind of want to emphasize that, you know, we're coming more to the understanding that the mouth is part of the body, and what we're talking about here are people who are unable to do often to do much of their own or any of their own oral care. So we're not even. I appreciate that you said that, Representative Kiffmeyer, about how important it is to do prevention. But these are people who cannot do prevention often. They rely on staff. And so when we think about how much it costs to do an additional cleanings, you know, for this population, that if they don't get that kind of care, they may very well end up in the emergency room costing a whole lot more. It just makes so much sense to do this. And I know Representative Norton had limited this to the residential services, and that, you know, in a way, I other than the fiscal note problem, which I hope we can get around it, it makes sense to not limit this, frankly, because other dentists, and Dr. Sitzer is one who was here before, take care of these folks, too, in a private setting. And they also would, you know, they already take a big hit to take care of our folks anyway, because we don't pay enough to really cover the cost. And then they're unable to give them the care they need. They're unable to handle the, you know, if they need the sedation or whatever, then they've got to pay that out of their own pocket in addition to taking the underpayment that we give them. So I think this is a really important bill and, you know, one that has all kinds of ramifications for the folks we're trying to care for. And hopefully it really will save money and not just cost. And I hope we can account for that.
Well, thank you. Anybody else want to test? Oh, Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I did want to thank them for the work that they are doing, and I look back over my years of work in the nursing home, and we've talked about this, and I wanted to comment again that in the nursing home that I worked in, we had a beauty chair and a barber chair, but never had a dental chair, and the folks who were on MA then, because the dentists would not take MA patients in my town, so we had to get them ready and send them to Blooming Prairie, and we're no longer able to do that. So I still have, not all of us who age out have dentures. We actually try to preserve and keep our own teeth. And our spouses, and in the nursing home, I actually had this. A gentleman came. He would floss. His wife had a stroke. She was unable to care for herself. And they had put thousands of dollars into her mouth. And he came every night to floss. And I thought, I hope my husband heard that. So there is a big need for the care, and it's very important. It does affect the diabetes. It's very much a part of it. The plaque, you know, we all now know more about our teeth and the importance of caring for them. And I want to thank you for continuing to do that. And thank you, Representative Norton, for your work.
And, Mr. Chair, as large as you'd like to make this bill, as broad as you care to fund it, we would be happy to have it back fully.
Well, and, you know, it's been a very challenging last 4 years for all this. And there's some things that we had to do just because of the math. And some things, it made sense at the time to get us by a time, but some things don't make sense to maintain. And so I think this is, it's actually kind of fun we can talk about looking at some of these coming back even in theory, and maybe we can get part of them, and perhaps when your note comes in, if there's only so much you can actually reach out to a certain population that's extremely high need that will just be suffering without, that you could ask the department to consider looking at other parts that are more medium level and some of the offsets as they consider the impact. And I think that they're reasonably flexible with looking at a little broader look at some of this. So. Do you have any last comments?
Nope.
So the bill is held over. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. As amended. Rep. Some Lomer, you can come down. Ms. Erickson, would you walk? Come down and say hi to us. I want to say hi to your baby. I wish we were on TV. Would you just come down and
Well, he had to come for the client's bill.
Oh no, it's outstanding.
He's gonna
no, but come down to the front and would you would you mind? Just come sit at the table for a second. We'll give you. Okay. So what's his
James Erickson.
Yeah, you know.
6 weeks today.
You know it's
and
yeah.
Was it the no prize? No prize today, so we're doing good.
Thank you. And that's pretty cool.
I know.
Reps in Hamilton moves the minutes.
So moved.
Yeah. Any questions about that? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Oh, and members, so Epson Lomer is going to move the bill, but the amendment's not being offered today. That's just there for recreational purposes, so
okay.
It'll stay there. Epson Lomer, do you want to move your bill for possible inclusion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to move House File 2529. And I'm not sure.
And that's for possible inclusion.
For possible inclusion. Thank you.
And so you can proceed with your testifiers, your comments. Or
okay, great. House File 2529 is a bill that's requesting financial support of $65,000 annually for a one-of-a-kind living skills program for persons throughout the state of Minnesota with intractable epilepsy and mental illness. This program supports individuals with a number of services that allow them to manage their illness and maintain their independence. Without this additional support, the $65,000, the program cannot continue to remain open and will be forced to close. Clients receiving regular services will then be without the assistance and skills training that has allowed them to remain independent and stable in their living situation. So without this funding, these folks might likely have to go to adult foster care, which would be considerably more expensive. So with me today, I have Jill Wiedemann-West, and she's going to add some additional information and answer questions. And then we also have
Dr. Connie DeLorme.
Dr. Connie DeLorme, thank you.
Okay, well, whichever you would like to offer some comments, please do.
I'm here as
Please say your name, if you
My name is Dr. Connie DeLorme from Rochester, Minnesota. My son, Craig, has been a member of this program for adults with intractable epilepsy since 1998. He has had epilepsy since birth. And I guess most people don't know what intractable epilepsy is. Just for your information, there's no uniform definition even in the medical field. Generally, it's described as a form of epilepsy when multiple drug trials and surgery do not tend to prevent or control the seizures. Craig was referred to the Minnesota Epilepsy Group in St. Paul from Mayo Clinic because his level of care was beyond what they could provide when he was 8 years old. He's at a very high risk of a sudden unexplained death in epileptic patients. In fact, we were told quite frankly when he was a teenager that usually people with his type of epilepsy do not live past the age of 30. He's now 35 and we're very grateful for every year we have with him. His types of seizures, you may think of seizures as somebody just jerking around, but I want to just elevate your understanding here. He has simple seizures where he does not lose consciousness. Sometimes it just sort of feels like I'm going to have a seizure, Mom. Or his lips can be tremoring. Or he could have a sudden motor jerk and swing his arm out. No control over it. He doesn't know what's happening. It just happens. But he is very aware of it. In fact, he can have generalized seizures where he is jerking all over and be aware of it. And he said, this is the scariest thing in the world, Mom, to see the people looking at you and you know what's going on and you can't do anything to help yourself. He also has complex seizures, which he is unaware of. He does normal activities, but he is completely unaware of it. When he was in kindergarten, he'd walk over and he'd actually pick up the turtle tank and drink the water out of the turtle thing. But they didn't know that. They thought he had a terrible home life because they didn't realize this was a type of seizure. He can be in an area, and if he has this kind of seizure and people don't know he's got this kind of seizure, boy, they think he's got to be a wacko. He also has gut seizures. When he has a gut seizure, he has no appetite. My son has a very healthy appetite. And when he says, I don't feel like I can eat, you know something's going on. He also has the standard generalized tonic-clonic seizures with the whole body moving. What happens, though, after these seizures, when he loses his consciousness, is variable. Sometimes he feels like he's been hit by a bus. If you've been shaking around with great intensity for 3 to 5 minutes and you finally come around 20 minutes later, you are confused. Every muscle in your body hurts for a period of several hours to a day. However, if he just has a simple seizure, he can get up and I'm just fine, and he can go on with his daily activity. So it's very unpredictable. He is of normal intelligence. Since the surgery to remove 20% of his brain to try to get rid of the focal points of the seizure, he's low normal, but he's still normal intelligence. He's an Eagle Scout. In 1992, he completed the requirements before he had the brain surgery. He graduated from high school in 1995, attended some community college courses. He was an AmeriCorps volunteer for 1 year. He wanted to live on his own. He felt that he could live on his own. He does not have any other mental health issues. We go to many of the programs by the Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota. And there our son met Ann Barnwell, who was the founder of the SEARCH program. This is a program that was designed for adults with epilepsy who might be able to live independently with support. They would evaluate and train adults with epilepsy for independent living skills. This is the only program with this mission in the state of Minnesota. It's housed in Hennepin County. Support is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The offices of the staff are located on the second floor. Our son has an apartment, an independent apartment, on the 16th floor. Initially, Olmsted County paid for Cray's supports from Rochester while he was in Minneapolis, in Hennepin County, for the first 2 years. At the end of the 2 years, he completed the training program. But because his neurologists were there, and he really felt he had more of a life there than he would have in Rochester, as an adult, he makes his own decisions. He wanted to live there and be with the program that would support him, the program that trained him. Well, this unique program was later operated by People Incorporated, and the name has been changed to People Incorporated Epilepsy and Mental Health. Many persons who have epilepsy also have mental health issues. It is estimated that if anyone has more than one seizure a month, which Craig can have 3 to 4 or 5 in a day, but if you have more than one seizure in a month, it decreases your quality of life. And you can't drive a car if you haven't been seizure-free for 6 months. Many people have seizures and are out functioning just fine. But for these people with intractable epilepsy, they cannot have the normal life that you and I might have. The supports that Craig could receive in other facilities, some of them could be handled in other facilities, like in foster care. However, the management of Craig's intractable epilepsy requires a unique service. Through special training and working with the Minnesota Epilepsy Group, People Incorporated staff can identify and stop Craig's seizures without calling ambulances, without emergency room visits. Saves a lot of money. He, however, needs to be observed for a couple-hour period for appropriate breathing after certain medication is given, because sometimes that's part of the sudden death with epilepsy is that they stop breathing, and they need to have someone there who can institute emergency care. If he's injured during a seizure, he needs medical evaluation, and a note is taped to his chest because he is not able to communicate information about drugs to the ER personnel. Frequent checks during the day and before bed allow the staff to interact with him enough to notice potential seizure activity, because sometimes Craig is unaware of seizure activity. However, he's out and about because he is an independent living adult. He seizures in the community, and this often results in an ambulance being called because people don't understand seizures. They see something going on, and he has an ER visit. Craig would end up hospitalized because the emergency room staff standard procedure would not give him his needed anti-epileptic medications on time. And if he doesn't get them on time, he's going to be having more intense seizures and get into a much more difficult situation, quite often being hospitalized for 3 to 5 days until he's normalized. Let me tell you, that takes a toll on him, it takes a toll on us. It's a financial toll, but for me, as a parent, rushing up from Rochester to some emergency room and hospital up in the Twin Cities with our son hanging in the balance, it's a very frightening situation. Since he's been with People Incorporated staff, his bracelet now has their number on it. They call the People Incorporated staff, and they make sure the emergency room knows he needs his anti-epileptic medication. Yes, he may have been injured. Do your testing, but don't forget to give him his medication. By following through on that, we have decreased admittance significantly from the ER into the hospital to only once last year. Before that, we're talking 15, 20, 30 times, depending on the year. The people of People Incorporated Epilepsy and Mental Health provide a unique service. They're the only one in the state of Minnesota that allow people who have intractable epilepsy that are capable of independent living to live independently with support. They are staffed 24/7 with trained personnel, not just some person coming in to be a warm spot. And it's a very cost-effective safety net for their clients with epilepsy.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Jill Wiedemann-West with People Incorporated. Many of our clients that are at Epilepsy and Mental Health Services receive funding under the CADI waiver. This was certainly a factor. We were hit particularly hard in those client areas last year with the rate cuts in CADI, which has left this program unsustainable without the aforementioned appropriation. People Incorporated's Epilepsy and Mental Health Services program provides for clients with seizure disorders, acquired brain injuries, or traumatic brain injury. The curriculum serves to achieve stable housing and find a purposed activity, be it employment, education, or volunteerism. The customized living portion targets clients in need of long-term care who would benefit from 24-hour access to awake staff. And our independent skills, living skills training helps participants learn skills to manage their finances, housing, medical care, community resources, transportation, and other life skills essential to maintaining their independence. The Epilepsy and Mental Health Services Program measures recipient outcomes in five areas: financial self-reliance, stable health, including access to health care, safe, affordable housing, and a functioning support network, and basic living skills. Clients learn that they are capable of living independently and within the community, just as you heard about the individual that was just discussed and his desire to live independently and alone. Without the additional dollars that we need to make this program sustainable, these individuals will cease to receive this very one-of-a-kind and important service. We receive individuals in this service from all over the state of Minnesota because it is the only one of its kind, and it would put these individuals at risk for being able to continue in an independent living situation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And sorry, we didn't. Can you please spell your last name just for the minutes? We just didn't get it.
It's hyphenated. It's WIEDEMANN-WEST.
Okay. Thank you. Do you want to say something else, Representative Lomer? I have a question for the department if you don't. Would Ms. Hamilton come down, please? So you come to the meetings and you get to come visit us. So. Hi.
Hi.
Welcome back. Sorry, so a few of your friends are here today. I know it's a much more of a group on Tuesday. Anyway, I'm quite familiar with this program. As a freshman, Governor Ventura eliminated it. It was the search program then. I learned a lot about it, and I'm quite fascinated and supportive of this. Some of the testimony was about if the program doesn't exist, people will be going somewhere else. Can you tell me, and so as you're working on the fiscal note, I know it's a straight up $65,000, but it seems if this program goes away, which it's at risk of because of the 10% reductions to the below needs individuals, which is this is the circumstance here, I think 9 of the 14 or something, over half of their people are low needs officially. Do you have any... I know I'm catching a cold, but do you have any comments about that and you could offer right now? And then as you look at the fiscal note, if there's some counter savings that we can get by keeping this program open that we're otherwise going to incur, can you comment about that, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Heidi Hamilton with the Department of Human Services. I think that we'll have to look at that as we look at the fiscal note. There are... I believe that the program does keep people out of more expensive settings, and so people might have to go to nursing homes and other settings that have more intensive supervision and that are more costly.
Right, and I know when we did our global waiver discussions, there was add-backs for people that would go into other facilities. And I presume when we did the 10% reduction that we took into consideration some people would be moving on because they wouldn't be served after. I don't remember your fiscal note, but I imagine you probably had some add-backs for that. So it seems if we can prevent some of those add-backs, in this case, a number of them, I would fear, that the 65, this actually appropriation could be zero net or even a savings. But I'm going to settle for zero. Mm-hmm. But if you could think about that and... that would be productive, and maybe you can hook up on the hallway with the I still don't have your last name very good. Is it Weedham S? Is that?
It's Weedham and West, but
Weedham
Jill is fine.
Okay, Weedham and West. Okay, sorry, I apologize. But maybe the two of you can chat just to get some demographics about the low needs people and what the impact has been. And I'm not criticizing you, I'm just trying to solve a problem. And it seems like to lose this program would be a tremendous loss to these individuals and to the state and to the program. So you can, do you want to say anything else or do you want to leave while you still can?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll just add that we do agree that the program meets a unique need in the state that no other program meets.
Thank you. I appreciate that and appreciate the reasonable flexibility that you can engage on this. So, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and while Ms. Hamilton is working on that, I think we also need to look at this program has been kind of grant-funded in a special way for years and has never been folded into our regular program or gone through that, and I think we need to kind of look at that. In fact, the language here implies that it's a transitional program. It leading to independent living, which is, I think, part of, you know, from the testimony, it sounds like that may not be a possibility for some of these individuals. And it means that the door is closed to additional people who might have these same issues. And so I think this whole area needs a little bit more thought to sort of long-term sustainability and also, you know, how we can transition those who can move to more independent living so that there's room at the inn for new people coming into the system. But I think, you know, having a program dependent on special appropriations year after year is tough, and all of us have special programs who'd love to be in that situation, but I think we need to kind of look at this one for sustainability in the longer run.
Mr. Lorem, is your son in the program, or is he just living in the same place?
No, he went through the transition program, and at that time, see, they have two programs. One is the transition, and then Hennepin County has so many apartments, some low-cost apartments, that you can decide where you're going to live afterwards, any place. And he chose to live there because he felt he needed the long-term support medically with their staff that they've got there. But they have the two. People would go through transition. I'd say probably 30% of the people that went through with him in 1998 were able to then transition to an apartment. There's levels of intractable epilepsy, and if you're only seizuring once a month, it's not the same as someone who's having a seizure day, two or three seizures, and then maybe okay for two or three days, and then another seizure day. It's very different. And what the long-term program helps are people who have the type of epilepsy that no matter what we do with drugs, no matter what we do with surgery, we cannot stop the seizures. But they are capable of living on their own. They're capable of living a life if they have these supports for when they have these seizure situations in place. But there are others who have been able to transition on and have gone back to their communities. When we started out, we assumed Craig would be able to come back to Olmsted County. Well, you know, we went around to every place we could find in Olmsted County, and there wasn't one place that would meet his needs for independence. He could go into a home where he would not have his independence. And they weren't trained, or people would sleep during the nighttime and nobody would be able to check on him if something went wrong. Whereas this program here, he waited out. he did an analysis, and he said, Mom, this is the best place for me. It's the only place I'm safe. And the fact that he's lived beyond the age of 30 years just has me beaming.
Ms. Valorum, didn't your son testify here?
Yes, I believe he did, Craig.
Yeah.
He was coming in.
All right, thank you. We remember that. And is he on a caddy waiver or a CAC?
Yes, he is. And he was described as low need. And both the social worker who did the analysis and his regular social worker said, that's just wrong. He is not a low needs individual.
And just one more question, then we can. So is he still in this program, or is he on his own? He's not one of the 14 people, is he? Is he an add-on person who's hanging around, or is he in one of the 14 or 16 people?
The program has levels of care, a continuum for individuals that we will go to them in their independent living situations. In the units that you heard described in Hennepin County, we have awake staff in that building that are checking on those higher needs, more that need more of that hands-on from staff with meds, etc. And so we have both programs, and the Hennepin units are the ones where we have the awake staff all the time.
But he wants to know if Craig's part of the 14.
Yes, he is.
Okay. And as long as he gets a little support, he stays lower needs. If he's on his own, he becomes high need. Is that
correct?
Oh, yeah. He wouldn't make it on his own.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we kind of started getting to the area of my question because Dr. DeLorme's been working and we've been communicating about the needs assessment and the fact that this low needs calculation, the needs assessment doesn't capture somebody like her son. And so she's been trying to work with the department on this, and I just want to see if maybe the department or maybe Dr. DeLorme can talk a little bit about how the intersection of that problem and issue with what we're talking about here, because I'm assuming that because the needs assessment doesn't capture these people's needs, that that's part of the reason this is all this we're getting the big cut here.
That's right. There's a funding cut, and with that funding cut, then they're having trouble maintaining. I mean, their staff right now is they're there, and they're doing their best, but they're really stretched, and the stress level is high on the staff at this point in time, trying to meet the needs with the cutbacks. It is really impacting my son's care as well. So, yes, the two are interwoven, and Pam Merkel and I, she's coming down to Rochester. We're meeting a week from Monday to take a look at the website form to see how things are weighed for when I went through all the stuff online that I could find, it was highly weighed for behavior problems. My son doesn't have a behavior problem, and so he would fall through the cracks as someone who has a low need, but where in reality, when he's not seizuring, he doesn't have much of a need. But when he's seizuring, he has a very high need.
Representative Liebling, do you want me to have Ms. Hamilton come back down? Do you want to ask her a question about the assessments? This is actually a big question.
That's
so maybe
huge,
Ms. Hamilton,
do
you want to come down? We have a few minutes left on this area, and there's certainly time for this very important question. I have Representative McDonald, and then we'll probably move on. But the next bill, I think there's ample time if we take a few more minutes on this. So welcome back. I guess you're popular today. Do you understand the question? Or do you want to, Representative Liebling, do you want to restate it, or should I?
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. No, well, if you'd like to, because I see that you have interest in this, too, so why don't you go ahead?
Well, the one of the challenges in this low needs thing is what's low need. There have been anecdotes about people who were reduced in the high need reductions in the past and also got reduced in the low need reduction in this round, which is somewhat ironic. And we also discovered that there's not a mental illness, or this isn't even that. The component that describes a person with seizures is neither mental illness nor, you know, behavioral issues or capacity to do your ADLs. And so some of those got caught up wrongly in a low needs, and some were. But can you comment about that whole topic? Is that clear enough?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do recognize that our current assessment documents are not as robust as they should be in certain areas, and particularly with individuals with mental illness. That's been an area that we've heard. That's why we're in the process of developing the MN Choices assessment tool, which will replace all of our current assessment tools for the waiver programs and home care services. We've been working very hard with all the different stakeholder groups and different population to make sure that assessment tool does capture what it needs to capture to assess all of the needs of people. Our current long-term care assessment tool was developed for seniors, and then it was modified to accommodate people with physical disabilities, and so it doesn't address all of the needs of the population that we serve.
In the tool, the
actually,
current...
Just, you have to wait for me to call on you, but go ahead, doctor. Is it Dr. DeLong?
Yeah.
Okay, doctor.
In the current tool, if you have epileptic seizures twice a month, you're all lumped together. There's a special thing saying that requires extra care as a little checkpoint, but it doesn't move you up on the list. And that's one of the things that Pam Merkel and I will be looking at next week.
Very nice. So, Epson Liebling, is that helpful?
Thank you.
And actually, something else that came out of this, I've actually had many meetings over this. I took August off, and since September we've been talking about this, that the department was unaware of the concentration of some of these low-needs type individuals. They don't keep a census of that. They keep track of where the individual, but they don't keep track of how they group together. And so some sites got much more impact on that reduction than others. They had a very low percentage or a high percentage. So thank you very much. Thanks for coming down, Ms. Hamilton. Representative McDonald, you get the last question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So kind of you. Appreciate it. My question is in lines of Representative Loeffler and Chairman regarding the appropriations of the $65,000. I recognize the importance of this program, and certainly I think the most valuable tool for us will be the fiscal data as to how much it saves the state by getting this group of folks responsible and on their own. So a very good program and a message, and thank you, Representative Lohmer. My question is twofold. One, when this is added to the base of the Department of the Health and Human Services, Department of Health, is that correct? Human Services. Will that just stay for the program? And then will they get an increase each year, I suppose, depending on the legislature? And then can we perhaps possibly have that data brought to us back next year, next session, for the group to learn of what great things this had done?
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. McDonald, this is an appropriation for 2013, then it's added to the base for the future. And so it's the bill is something of a placeholder. The amount that they're short based upon the reductions they got, this is the what they thought they needed to keep the program open. I urged them to get the number as low as it could be, and this is what they came back with. And maybe Ms. Weedham Mest could comment about that if you'd like about. But this is in the base, and anyway, so I'll just...
I mean, we're certainly looking always at the most efficient and effective way to provide services. We do fundraise independently, and are hoping to find potentially other avenues for funding the epilepsy mental health services. The $65,000 is really intended just to fill the gap that's been created by both the CADI cuts as well as really that it's not been increased. The overall amount that we receive has not been increased. The rates that we receive have in many cases been cut over the years in terms of the different things that we bill for under MA, etc. So it's something that's been a growing gap for a period of time, and that ultimately we hope that we'll find better and more long-term sustainable ways to fill. But in the meantime, $65,000 is what keeps the program open.
Epson McDonald.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just to understand, because I hate to say I'm still new at this, but so now next year or the following, then that monies can't be taken away for use if it's in their general base appropriations. They can't use it for another project, can they?
Representative McDonald, this would be appropriated. Actually, it's specific to what it's appropriated. It's appropriated to the, not to you by name, but it describes the program. And so if there were another program identical, they'd have to decide who gets it, but nobody else does this. And so it's specifically for this purpose, and because there's only one, they put it out to RFP, there'd be one person applying, and it'd be them. And so it's going to go for this purpose, if you read the language. And the language might need some work. But anyway, so I think that's good enough for now. And any other comments from people? It's been a very good hearing. I appreciate the attention to this, and
the
bill's held over.
Thank you.
You all have some homework to do. So the last bill on the agenda today is Representative Kiff Meyer's House Bill 2276. And
that's okay.
Oh, did I, Representative Hamilton? No, did you have a question? You can. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. You have a minute to do it. Go ahead.
What?
You wanted to say, you have a minute to do it. Go ahead.
What?
You wanted to say something, there's transition time. I can unlay it over and you can... It's fine. Okay. I'm sorry, I didn't see you. Saw you're hiding behind a very large stacker there. So. Too much of those coconut M&Ms, I'm afraid.
No. Mr. Chair, if I could have a page to distribute some information.
Sure. And and so do you wish to, all of the, Representative Kiffmeyer moves House File 2276 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. So, and I believe you have an amendment under the DE2.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the DE2 amendment.
Okay, and this is the first hearing this bill's had, so it's appropriate to make it say whatever you want. And so we'll move the amendment to get it in order that you like, and then you can describe your bill and everything. So everybody understand the motion? We're doing the DE2 amendment. Hearing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Adopted. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your time on the committee today. And this is a consumer protection bill for MRI facility and services, and currently Minnesota does not require any MRI accreditation standards. And there are some issues that are coming up. I know it's amazing that there could be possibly something that escaped us. But nonetheless, some of these new technologies, they come forward, and we're aware of this. So sometimes in these cases, we may have older equipment being used and not complying with accreditation standards, and especially minimizing safety risks when you have magnetic resonance imaging environment with the following. And it may be a variety of issues that could be dealt with here. But the accreditation program will set quality standards for practices, provide an objective peer-reviewed assessment of facilities through evaluation of personnel qualifications, equipment requirements, quality assurance, quality control procedures, pretty typical that goes with an accrediting process, and the evaluation of clinical and phantom image quality as well, which is very, very important in the reading of these, that they be accurately done. And these standards will apply to all insurance programs in Minnesota and are the same standards that would be required for Medicare and Medicaid programs. And today with me I have Dr. Keith Pendleton. I'm sorry, Mr. Keith Pendleton, you're JD. I was
a doctor of sorts.
A doctor of sorts, okay. Who will testify in support of the bill and also can answer additional questions that the committee may have. And so, Mr. Chairman, if I could have Mr. Pendleton.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Pendleton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Keith Pendleton, and I'm here on behalf of Summa MRI, which is an open MRI facility located in Golden Valley, Minnesota, and it's also accredited by the American College of Radiology. And it's been the experience of Summa MRI where quite frequently Summa MRI has to re-perform MRIs performed in some cases by mobile MRI units, which are over two decades in age, where they're being performed in strip malls. And Dr. Terry Yocum, who is a world-renowned radiologist, pioneered or drafted the pioneering essentials of skeletal radiology. He's Dr. Terry Yocum is affiliated with Summa MRI, and he refers to these MRIs as fogograms. And in any event, what's been happening is that these MRIs have been being billed to payers, including Medicare, Medicaid, private payers, accident-based payers, including worker comp payers, and automobile insurers. And this is resulting, when they have to be redone, it's resulting in payers having to pay twice. Okay, and so what has happened now is a number of states, and most recently Medicare, as well as some major private payers, have begun to adopt a requirement, either by law or by contract, a requirement that these advanced diagnostic imaging services facilities be accredited, privately accredited, through some one or more private accrediting organizations. And so this bill would essentially take that requirement that Medicare has adopted, other states have adopted, and would apply it across the board in the state of Minnesota, irrespective of not only what payers involved, but whether it's a cash-paying patient. Cash-paying patients would be protected from this kind of performance. The five elements of accreditation, the five focal points of any accrediting organization program includes personnel qualifications, making sure the personnel are qualified, equipment requirements, quality assurance, quality control procedures, and also evaluation of clinical and phantom image quality. Those are the five main focal points in these accrediting organization programs. And so we're talking about improving quality, ensuring safety to the patients, and following the example of federal and state authorities in adopting a similar type of requirement here in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a particular interest in this because for the patients, when you don't have those standards, you can either have a false positive or a false negative. You can get a false sense of I'm okay when you aren't, or the extra costs that are associated and the stress and the worry that comes from acting on that and then finding out later you're okay. But there's always that nagging question that you have. And so from the patient's perspective, we want to do that. And then there's a potential drive cost from ignoring or falsely thinking everything is okay and you have a cancer, you have something else or a heart condition going on, and you're not treating it, which can many times lead to loss of life or later more expensive need for treatments. And in particular with some of the mailings that are going out, elderly and others are particularly vulnerable to that. And so this is very important that if these are being done and they choose to pay on their own and whatever they do, at least it has a quality level that has protects the patients to make sure that if they're being done, the outcomes and the results of it should be dependable.
Thank you. Rustin and Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Well, question I have about this, I mean, first of all, Representative Kiffmeyer, it is a little odd that you're here asking us to regulate something that isn't regulated now. So there, that, you know, I guess things, sometimes you need regulations. But I'm kind of wondering here, if the payers who pay for these services don't already apply some kind of quality control to this, you know, granted, there are always pros and cons to these kinds of things. And quality control, certainly when we license something, when we accredit something, we're trying to make sure that the person or thing meets a certain standard of quality. But the other side of that is that we're probably raising costs. So, you know, when you say, I get what you're saying about false positives and false negatives, but a lot of that, I think, depends on the radiologist also who's reading it. And I would think that, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think you can make any sense out of these without a radiologist to read it. And if you've got a radiologist who's competent and they are licensed, I would think that that in itself would put some kind of quality check on this.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling. I would just do a case in point. First of all, everybody, there are regulations already. This is just making sure that everybody follows those same regulation or accreditation standards. But secondly, a radiologist can only read the quality that's there. For instance, a very common thing right now is digital mammography instead of the old school mammography. And without a question, you want to be sure that the radiologist has, first of all, the best quality image to read, or his knowledge and extensive skills are not very valuable if the image is poor. But Mr. Pendleton also has some comments and knowledge about that, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Pendleton.
Yes, just to follow up on a point just raised there is that this requirement is now in place for any facility that's going to file claims with Medicare, which is going to include a lot of facilities. I'll also mention that on the websites of Aetna, Mid-America Region, United Healthcare, and some of the major Blues payers, they also now require accreditation. So the emphasis of this bill would be to ensure that everybody receives the same level of protection, mm-hmm. Including even those who don't have insurance.
Representative Liebling.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I feel like I don't really understand the whole landscape of what's going on here. I mean, could you give me, first of all, I didn't get what organization you're with and what your organization does. And then I guess I'm wondering about, is there any opposition to this? I don't know if anybody's here to speak to it. But
Absolutely. After we finish two questions, I'll see if anybody wants to testify to it. So, Mr. Pendleton, you want to respond and we'll...
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to make sure I heard the questions correctly, if you would just repeat.
Oh, Representative Liebling, do you want to summarize your
thanks,
questions?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, I guess I wanted to know who you're with and, you know.
Lawyers can't talk more clearly to each other, either.
Yeah. Anyway, what's your interest, what the interest is in this. You know, I guess I'm not really fully understanding what's driving the bill coming forward right now, and so I'm kind of didn't quite catch who you're representing here.
Mr. Pendleton.
Yes, I'm speaking on behalf of SUMA MRI, which is an open MRI facility located in Golden Valley, Minnesota.
Representative Liebling.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. So, Mr. Pendleton, so how does this affect your facility then? I don't understand. Are there some people that are, how does it affect your facility?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way it affects our facility is the patients of our facility having to go through the procedure twice and having to be responsible potentially for two sets of MRIs.
Representative Liebling?
I'll leave it at that, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Representative Loeffler and Hamilton, do you want me to ask for witnesses first to do this one? Representative Liebling or Loeffler, go ahead, it's fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There's time
for
both.
I'm just a little confused. We have a handout in our packet that seems pretty dated. It refers to piloting things in 2008, but it does indicate that CMS had, in January of 2010, okayed three different routes to accreditation, and I only see two in the bill. And the last one is the joint that isn't included in this bill is the Joint Commission. Now, maybe that's because hospitals get that accredited through another way, but I would like to know why that third entity isn't here in the accreditations that are listed in the bill.
Mr. Pendleton, Representative Kiffmeyer, which...
It's my understanding that the third one will be introduced. The bill was originally drafted focusing on two because up until relatively recently, there's really only been two organizations that have focused it on the accreditation requirements. Now, with the passage of Medicare adopting that third, it's my understanding that that will be added to the bill.
Mr. Chairman, do you want to make an oral amendment?
Yes, I would be glad to do it. Mr. Chairman, we didn't get this change 24 hours before the committee deadline, and I was reluctant to do that. But it's easily added and glad to do so.
Well, and we have a rule about it, but this is going to the floor, and I think in situations that are where it's small and there's no disagreement, does anybody mind if we include that other group? Anybody have an objection to that? So maybe staff can come up with an amendment that would incorporate whatever that third group is.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Loeffler.
I would just ask that before this is dealt with on the floor that we find out, since this is a January of 2010 announcement, if there's any other group that's been certified by CMS accreditation, because we've gotten into, on other bills, debates about who's all the accreditors, and we have to make sure it's everyone who's under CMS.
Okay, good point. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Kiffmeyer
for your ability to seek balance when it comes to legislation that's not overly restrictive and yet still protect the consumer. Thank you. And I'm a little, I was a little shocked when you brought this forward, thinking that this isn't regulated already. And so my question would be, it's hypothetical, but could I do this right now? Could I purchase an MRI machine, put it in a van, and join up with Representative McDonald and drive around and perform these the way it sets today?
Representative Kiffmeyer, is this a business opportunity?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if it is, I think I'm rapidly seeing the sanity of this is expertise that you would need to have. But could you possibly, under current law?
Mr. Pendleton, would he be allowed to do that?
I know of no law that prevents you from opening up an MRI facility.
Hurry up, President Hamilton, the bill's been passed.
I'm on board.
I think we got a... This is actually... Representative Kiffmeyer, this is actually... Is this a jobs bill then, or is this actually... Okay. So we're working on an amendment. Before, as that's getting worked on, is anybody in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this? Nobody. Okay. Is the amendment ready? Why don't you just read it to it?
Okay. All right, just do that, yeah.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would read, it would be to the DE2, and it would read page 1, line 17, delete or, page 1, line 18, before the period, insert or, 3 in parentheses, the Joint Commission.
Representative Loeffler, that's your amendment if you want credit for it. Does that sound satisfactory to you?
It does.
Okay. Everybody understand the amendment? Mm-hmm. Anybody want to talk about that in the audience? Okay, then. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment's adopted. Other members want to have any questions or comments? Representative Franson.
Hi, thanks, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, could you tell me how this would affect hospitals and who would be left out?
Mr. Which of you, whichever one of you would like to testify?
Should I talk about the amendment?
I believe none.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Franson, the Hospital Association already has, if you see there, it says licensed under sections 14450 to 14456 on line 1.7. They have another, it isn't that they're being exempted from doing this, it's that they have another section of law at which it is accomplished. And so any facility that is affiliated with or owned by such hospital does go through this under section listed there on line 1.7.
So the answer is none are affected. Anybody else? We could get done early. That would be a little unusual. Seeing no more discussion, Representative Kiffmeyer renews for a motion that House File, whatever this is, 2276, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. Any people understand the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The bill is re-referred as amended. And next week we have more bills. Right? Mm-hmm. More bills next week. Have a nice weekend. Drive safely. We're adjourned.